So I'm going to try to pretend like I'm talking to my grandmother so that everyone can hear me. Kate Marvin, I would like to make a confession to you in front of all these witnesses. I am a stalker. Not a tapping on your window while you're sleeping or leaving your crazy, creepy, midnight voicemail messages from your phone type of stalker. What I've upset slash possessed with you. We actually met a couple of years ago. We gave a craft talk at the Writer's Studio in New York City. The craft class at the Writer's Studio consisted of alternating between reading fiction and poetry each week and discussing how we can apply the writer's techniques and methods to our own work. While I appreciate the poetry we read, I consider myself strictly a fiction writer. It wasn't until we were assigned your second poetry book, Fragments of the Head of a Queen, that everything changed. In part one of Fragments of the Head of a Queen, I read the first lines of the poem, The Pet. I rode him through the village smiling. He talked his passive name in distress. The villagers took his gestures as vanity and made no attempt to rein him back. By the time I reached the end of the poem, where you write, once I took him in, he grew. Now, I could not remove him without killing him, which frankly, I have never wanted to do. I sat up in my bed and I said, okay, Kate Martin, you got my attention. I kept reading and reached. She wishes her beloved were dead and read the lines. It's only three. So I tipped the bottle toward her glass. Brash, my hand remembers its place near me, but you're as prim as a closed umbrella, useless in this arid climate. You sniff as if you can smell a wedding in the air. I repeated that last line over and over. After I got to scenes from the Battle of Us and read the first lines, you were like a war novel, entirely lacking female characters, except for an occasional letter, which makes one of the men cry. I Googled you. The poetry made me feel all types of feelings I had never felt before, and I had to find out more about you. The next day at my engineering job, I got to the title of the poem, Teen Love's Horse Pit. And I turned to my cute mate and said, so you can just do that? You can just do that in poetry? My cute mate, thankfully, was used to my strange offers, just nodded and said, yes, you can. I remember writing the path while reading the last poem in your book. You cut open, and you named the last stanza of that poem. I want to bury my hands in your guts, breathe in the mineral rust of your blood gone bad and dead. Rich push, bury myself beneath your hide, live beneath this ruby slickness, to push my own bones into you. Not my fingers in your hair, slack flax, salt and rock, water and rock, they're done with you, my eyes crack open. I looked on the train and I wanted to scream, what is this book doing to me? So that day at the Writer's Studio, in a small room in that building in Wall Street, you sat at one end of the table talking about your motivations behind certain poems, and I just stared at you the entire time. I think the only thing I said was my name. Later, I decided I was going to tell you exactly how I felt, so I started following you on Twitter, but I never got the guts to tweet at you. And I still follow. I attended AWP in Seattle a couple of years ago. And my friends and I had 1,000 things on our agenda, where I told them over and over, we've got to go to the Hugo House tonight because Kate Martin's going to be there. We get there, and you actually walk past me, and the only thing I did was stare at myself. Growing up in the New York metro area, I've had the opportunity to meet lots of artists, writers, and celebrities. And with the exception of my single interaction with President Barack Obama, I had never been so starstruck in my life. So when the email went out at the start of the semester, introducers, I figured this was my one time to suck it up, get my shit together, and tell you how much your work has impacted me. You were my entry into poetry, and I cannot thank you enough for that. You really changed my life. Kate Marvin's first book, World's Tallest Disaster, was chosen by Robert Pinsky for the 2000 Katharine A. Morton Prize and published by Sarah Byrne Books in 2001. In 2002, she received the Kate Tufts Discovery Prize. She co-edited with poet Michael Duminis the anthology Legitimate Dangers, American Poets of the New Century. Her second book of poems, Fragment of the Head of a Queen, for which she received the Whiting Award, was published by Sarah Brand in 2007. Marvin teaches poetry writing in Lesley University's Residency MFA program and is a professor of English at the College of Staten Island the community in New York. In 2009, she co-founded the nonprofit organization VITA, Women in Literary Arts, with poet Erin Ballou. In 2015, behind Fellow, her third book of poems, Oracle, was released from W.W. Norton and Company in March 2015. I'm pretty sure she's going to be reading that book today. I urge all of you to listen closely. Let her words wash over you. Let her make a scoffer out of you. It is my great honor to introduce my favorite poet, Kate Martin. Against women and women dying and all that good stuff that women have to think about all the time. But Oracle specifically, actually I'll tell you why I wrote it. I wouldn't have written it if I wasn't asked by the Academy of American Poets to write a poem and get this is so fucked up, on the anniversary of Sylvia Plath's death, right? And I was like, who does that, right? And then I was like, but someone else will write this poem and it will suck. Why I have to write it. So, and I just did this big class symposium, and also like that year I was teaching the Bell Jar, and the Steubenville rape stuff was going on. So this basically is like a weave of the Bell Jar and that media coverage of that rape and personal stuff. So. Oracle. Dead girls don't go the dying route to get known. You'll find us anonymous still, splayed in Buicks, carried swaying like calves. Our dead half swung from ankles, wrists hooked by hands and handed over to strangers, slippery as blackout. Slammed down, the mud on her dress is black as her dress, worn out as a throw rug beneath the feet that stomp out the most intricate weave. It ought not sadden us, but sober us. Sylvia Plath killed herself. She ate her sin. Her eye got stuck on a diamond stick pin. You take Blake over breakfast, only to be bucked out your skull by a catcall crossing a parking lot. Consuming her while reviling her, conditioned to hate her for her appetite alone, her problem was she thought too much. Needling an emblem's ink onto your wrist, the surest defense of rose to reason against that bluest vein's insistent wish. Let's all of us today finger sweep our cheekbones with two blood marks, and ride that terrible train homeward while looking back at our blackened eyes inside tiny mirrors fixed inside our plastic compacts. We could not have known where she began, given how we were from the start, made to begin where she ends. In this way, she's no way to make her amends. So the idea behind that is that it's really like this first thing we learned about Sylvia Plath, that she killed herself. It's really not the biggest thing she ever did, when you come right down to it. She lived a lot more than she died. I'm going to read a poem called After Aftermath. This is one of those poems that you write and you don't remember you write it, and you find it just like, ooh. After Aftermath. Orphan boys
plus my mean calculations. Orphan boys plus desire equals their long bodies. How they sucked summer long water off a garden hose from beside the trailers. Their mean mothers weary of them sharing rooms in mental hospitals. I want to meet them with flowers, thank them for offering up their sons to this, our glazed plexiglass world. What will we do if not for them? Not for them, how could I breathe? How would I know what to do if I did not have to care for them because they learned how to not care for themselves because of you? Orphan boys make mean men. Because of them, I feel mean. I make my calculations because I love them and loving how they're dropping off the other end of their phones. They hang up on me. You hung up on them. I'm tired of your ultimatums, skunk mom. My eyes squeeze. I'm unhappy with you, Mom. You're not my mom, but I'm calling you Mom now that I'm his mom, Mom. Your son can't say what he thinks because you didn't teach him how to articulate himself, Mom. Shh, your beautiful baby's asleep. I'm a mom, too. You left him alone in that room that night he heard you rocking on the sofa, Mom. Said he saw a ghost. It shooed him from the doorway so he would not see you fussed up on the sofa. He was just a little kid, Mom. But I get it. Kids forget. I've got your kid in my bed now, Mom. It's inky in here where you forget him, Mom. I love him as stars lick our faces with the nose wet cold of cat kisses. I had thought of men as flowers. I picked a few. Then I met your son, Mom. He's still weaving flowers so that belt swish in your basement. And isn't it on nights like this, Mother? Thought of killing yourself looks you head on, beautiful in the face, velvety and faithful as in its gaze as that of the violet iris. This is men, Mom. Your mistake was begetting one. Mine was letting him in. He's asleep now. Shh, your son is safe. What about you, Mom? What about me? We're only daughters. Who's become our father? Your son, Mom. Your son. Called My First Husband Was My Last, and it sort of moves, it varies, like the stanzas kind of shrink and extend, so I like to think it sort of performs at different speeds, and in it, it's basically about the speaker as, she's recalling being arrested for a DUI, it's associated home about marriage. My first husband was my last. If not for this one fond thought, trees wave their violent weight. Heaved in air with storm's hand. They confiscated my hair elastic. They confiscate my bra. As each could twist into a noose, my bra wire sawed into a shiv. And we are both stubborn, asleep side by side until the night before we would never sleep again side by side. Neither of us was willing to be put out, sleep on the couch. Falling into bed, he dropped his mouth by my ear to mutter deep, "You'll change yourself to death." Yet we had much in common. We were both nocturnal as bats. We both smoked furiously. We each had a tendency to interrupt people mid-sentence, though we each hated nothing more than being interrupted. We each had a tendency to hurl death threats. Enormously seductive on first impression, once our targets succumbed to our wiles, we stared back at their love, appalled, our eyes dead diamonds. We voted Democrat and loathed the rich. We considered our intelligence unassailable. We were unbearable. Yet my fondest memory is when he arrived to bail me out of jail, and I do not intend a metaphor. He was the only one who saw me wince when they tightened the handcuffs. It was for his ear I quoted Keats while being walked into the precinct. Forlorn, the very words like a bell. Never an early riser, he did not fail to arrive at the jail near dawn. I saw him pacing before that plexiglass partition, serving as a portal to that room in which I stood, wearing the obligatory orange jumpsuit and orange blaze, thick with the company of other women who had also done some bad things wrong. I'd run a yellow light. He wanted his late-night snack at the country kitchen, heard a siren stop us, thought in fright my bowels might run loose down the insides of my pants leg. Trying to walk through to the line, so scared shitless was I. I suppose any man who ever hopes to know me must know this about me, that that's why I drove that night. Yet it's also true that Mike foretold how a shadow can strive to overtake another how a shadow can strive to overshadow another shadow. Some of us apparently wake only for these sorts of battles. For though I lay silent, assigned to rest on the cell's concrete floor on a thin pallet, thrummed asleep by my cellmate's snores, the thought that I had arrived at a punishment so terrible made me feel a certain kind of pride. Like my dear friend who died, he was not my ex-husband. He is, I'm told, still very much alive. Told me how he threw himself off from trees he'd climbed to see how he'd bleed when he was a child. Feeling the damp from concrete walls seep ache into me became just another way I found to feel myself alive. Yesterday, I received notice I failed to pay a civic fine, a penalty I incurred from an arrest that the court long ago dismissed. Although I distinctly recall filling out a sum of $200 for that particular money order back in 1999, payable to the Iowa Department of Motor Vehicles. No record of this payment exists, though judging by the clerk's sharp lead tickling the ether as she read aloud my crime from off computer screen. Although 14 years have slipped beneath us all, and I can't remember that town's street names, I'll never fuck the mean notoriety of that sad local newspaper's entry, DUI. I was placed in a 48-hour lockdown program as reprieve, as a first-time offender admitting my offense, a program operating, would you believe, out of the Heartland Hotel in Coralville. A bunch of drunks under one roof being taught how to not use alcohol, reminded how each of us fucked up, to the point each of us wept. Among us, a 16-year-old who drove herself into a snowbank well over the legal limit. And me, I was feverish to leave, so as to be back with him, my first husband, who had scored a good lead on pot from a friend I made over that weekend. Every bit of this is off record. They confiscated my hair elastic, even the mugshot, which I can only hope has been destroyed. Terrible dark then. My hair rode its idiot storm atop my head. What's utterly clear, yet remarkably clear in retrospect, is how I felt a freak urge to sneer or grin at the flash. They let me keep my underwear and socks. They confiscated my pocket change and wedding ring. And if not for that one moment when I stood within the gaggle of orange-suited women, one of whom growled, "Driving? You'll be back." But I saw him pass before the plexiglass as he saw me, looked back, and he had mouthed to me against it all, "You look beautiful." My stare drained within the fluorescence. Could I forget any of it ever happened? He told me I would die as I lay beneath our shared coverlet. He told the shared acquaintance I did not care enough for the written word. This was, in itself, blasphemy. So I was a cunt who cut his vocal cords, or I was rich and hid my treasure. He kept company with petty thieves. His one friend stole coins out of laundry machines. He's familiar to me as a dust mote. He's familiar to me as a carved wood mask we hung on our walls. He's a gape, always a gape. My first husband was my last. He's my love canal. It's a miracle anyone ever married me. It's a miracle anyone ever married him. He's digging himself up in Transylvania. He's pulling the stake out of his heart with his yellow teeth. His awful teeth aren't his fault. He was raised inside a tin can. He was suckled with corn syrup instead of breast milk. I think of him at the polls. I feel his thoughts collect like chalk dust in my nose. I wake up in a sweat. I wouldn't be surprised if I woke up next to him tomorrow. We are celebrating the 4th of July. I have brought home a rotisserie chicken, which we enjoy pulling apart and licking its grease from our fingers. And later we'll find ourselves in bed, the bed in which we will make death threats to one another, upon which we shall blame one another all our bitter, long lives. I once slammed the door in his face so hard. If he had been standing an inch closer, his fangs would have been knocked down his throat. Or rather, landing ass flat at his door's parting slap, tailbone cracked, I chose to clatter back down the hall, my pinchers snapping through the smoke waters we'd made of our habitat. The only reason we got married was because we didn't know one another. But it is not true that I chased him with a kitchen knife, ever. I always want to explain when I come to the part about getting, you know, you get to keep certain things when you're in jail. And I got to wear my socks, but that night I was wearing the socks my mom gave me that had ice cream cones all over that. And I was just like, oh no. Oh no, because let's see how neat, because I actually don't care. So I'm going to read a few high school poems. The first one is called High School is a Dead Girl. I had this situation where I went to China, my college, and I went into the high schools and was like, oh shit, this happens all over the world. Like, everybody has to stop with this. High School is a Dead Girl. High school was us and we. We learned our grammar there. It became devised by bell sawing halls sharp as number two pencils. We grew thin, dark to men in his hallways. We grew up on men. Our breasts, their beards, our breasts, while we cracked open beer cans in the girls' room, swabbed out phone minutes before walking into home run. I was known to be dumb, attention, a kill myself kind of girl. But it was you who shot herself in the head. What kind of girl shoots herself in the head? You wanted a quality kill? Take some sleeping pills, spare your mother the blood grief. You always took the hit for me, turned around with your seat. Did you hear what they said? Yes, some of us are intending to go to college. You lose our grief. Then the tarry hot of the parking lot rose up, black, promising me any boy's face bent the crack against my face that was becoming a face, when we wanted what we all wanted, to be pretty, which then meant famous. Okay, so do any of you remember when industrial arts was taught in high school? Okay, it was very gendered, but you either took home ed or you took industrial arts. So this is up in the voice of the industrial arts teacher. Called High School Industrial Arts. The lesson today is someone always gets hurt. Will it be you or another fool? This is a choice. We provide the tools and materials, the saws, the wood, nails, and supervision. Fall not now in love, for it is merely a distraction from your assignment. Now create this uninspired name plaque, build stacks of unstable shelves, lament your lack of craft as a of your lust forms in vaporous pools on the floor just below your work table. You thought this class would mean an easy credit. Welcome to our workhouse. No one leaves this building whole. Consider now how this building's roof's akin to the lid of a jar, tightly screwed, and you're the inhabitant within. You're scrabbling at its glass, yet we've punched no holes in the aforementioned lid. Now make something. Make something no one can use that no one wants. Don't ask why. It builds character. Someday you'll look back on these days fondly. Here are your goggles. There's the eye rinsing station. Wasn't that always on this, right? No, this is not art. Ladies, stand back. We don't want you cutting those pretty fingers off or sawing yourselves in half. This is a man's work. You, wipe that smirk off your face. Last thing I need is one of you girls dying on my watch. I think I'm going to segue into a poem called Yellow Rubber Gloves. I'll go down. Now, I always wanted to write a poem called Yellow Rubber Gloves. It was like one of my goals in life, and no one I knew really understood this or appreciated it. But they really like me, they're so weird, aren't they? And, when you've had this experience of doing someone's dishes for a really long time, you start to take it personally, right? And it was sort of like coming out of jail, not having to like wash his parents' dishes anymore. You know, but I still use yellow rubber gloves. You know why? It's fun. Yellow rubber gloves. Sisters, why bother? The telling is done. I once fancied myself censurer, sweeping the floors with my tail as my arms sunk deep into dishwater, half lost, indeed looking almost as if they'd been clean and locked off. Mopping up all that blood, rusty strings on the mop dragging their fat hairs along the linoleum. I'm never surprised when someone calls me lady, though they may as well call me a cleaning lady. Though I know they mean lady, as in, what the hell do you think you're doing, lady? And merely washing dishes. Yours. It makes me want to give in, adopt those dozen cats. Makes me nervous enough to count how many cigarettes I've got left. I've seen the lines inching across my face. I'm wise enough to know no great plans are afoot. I've no hope of launching any ships. And besides, I'm done with beauty. They say the hands go first, then the eyes. Then you get a little pinched, whiskery around the lips. I'm not averse to invisibility. I'm already used to getting shoved aside anyway, sitting small as a pin between men, spreading their legs on packed subways. I'm the one cunt who should have known long ago. It's about time I shut my fucking hole. But bring my hands deep into suds. Watch me muck with the dirt of men's dishes. You'll see I really know what I'm doing. My advice, yellow rubber gloves will save your hands, young bitches, awful twats who think you'll never be me. Trust me as I never trusted myself. We're in this together. Look at your hands. Who else did you think he had in mind, undermining your time by leaving dish after dirty dish behind? And try using a milder solution. It may bubble up less, but being less caustic, the fewer skin cells it destroys. Also, lotion is important. Apply it just after washing dishes and every night before you go to bed. Who do you sleep beside? So, Aaron wants me to read a very foul poem that I wrote many years ago. And
it's so sweet.
It's a very sweet poem, yes. It's a loving, lovely poem. It's called Tea Slug Horse Dick.
That's so well.
So basically, this poem came about because I got an email and it's such a hit, Teens Love Horse Dick, right? And I was like, whoa. This is like, you know, it was coming in with all this spam with like erectile dysfunction stuff. And I was like, wow, that's totally, that should be a title for a poem. So. I just immediately, when I saw, I just saw it like in the table of contents. I was like, yes. And then I think I didn't get a job because I repeated the title so many times, I would just keep repeating it and chuckling, you know? And people were like, this is called Teens Love Horse Dick. So much pornography one cannot afford. They say there's a lady who spreads herself so wide she welcomes inside the entire world. So many innuendos I would prefer to miss. A man said all young girls who love horses are naturally suspect. He raised an eyebrow. When he left, all he left was trash. A closet clogged with old shirts and letters, note cards on which he had listed things he wished I had done for him naked, but hadn't. When young, there was nothing I wanted more than a horse. On the cards, his cursive soared toward what he wanted. There was no room for a horse in the city where I grew. So I began collecting plastic models. I had a tiny leather saddle for my favorite. What it was he needed, I must have managed to ignore. After we split our address, I read his notes. Acquire the this injury. My questions are numerous. How did they get my address? If teams do, in actuality, love horsedick, how did I remain unaware of this preoccupation throughout my adolescence? They say they take credit cards. They say we should drive down the coast and cross over into Mexico. They suggest we head first to see a donkey show, where a lady spreads herself so wide you can see constellations beam out from inside of her. This is the world he wanted us to have. I want to come in your mouth. It was uncertain just who he addressed. There are things one would rather not know. I had intended for this recollection to be modest, but it would not be right to not tell you how, when we were together once, he told me very clearly that my technique would not do. This is not the worst thing I could tell you. I think I'll read the poem sort of right after that. It's kind of like in the voice, we're still in the poem, and it's like sort of in the voice of the male figure of the book. It's called All My Wives. I've been really remiss, and I haven't thanked anybody. And Aaron, thank you. Thank you, everybody at FSU. Thank you, Keith, wherever you are, for being such an excellent host. All my wives. When I say my wives are cages, I don't mean I'm a bird. Collapsible shelves, they hide their usefulness when not in use. All my wives contain terrariums, terrible embedded atmospheres, in which their salamander cells linger atop damp rocks. Their hands are damp as the tissues they ball in their hands, though none of my wives could make a fist, not even if I asked, no, not even if I commanded them to, an amusing idea I must someday revisit. My wives are like the small mammal house at the zoo, their rooms kept dark so visitors may view their nocturnal truce, that anonymous wakefulness whose sleepers do not care to know. None of my wives are like lanterns, nor do their ribs sing with canaries. It does my wives good to run my errands, for it keeps them purposeful. I do not allow pockets on their shirts or skirts. Theirs are unforgiving interiors. A woman's hands should always be in plain sight, preferably chafed from dishwater or cold. A woman's hands should be kept raw from wind and sewing. When I want my wives to come out, I turn off the lights and crouch to listen as they compare me. Who do I smack more often? Whom shall I take for my queen? They think I take pleasure in belaboring this decision, yet the thing of it is to imagine I might someday purchase a book I've never desired to read. When I snap the lights on, they scatter like roaches. Why read when there are so many worried brows upon which to set the delicate glass of my gaze down? One of my wives petitioned once. One of them dared to cry. They've tried to make me sad with their eyes. Let them try. I would rather buy a hat, a walking stick, move alone within my chamber, pose before my mirror. I do not need a queen. I do not like tantrums. At times I shudder, alone in my bed, when I consider how their desires must churn like the onset of inclement weather. It could be one, she could be 100. I just saw her shadow skulking down the walk. She's drunk as usual, her shakes, her heart murmurs, her general unease. Pity the creature, she has a disease. If it gets worse, I'll be forced to consider treatment. All my wives have four legs each. What we call arms may as well be legs, so it seems to me, as I kneel behind each, not knowing one from the other. Only their asses, moon curves, aglow with lamplight. With such anonymity, we are pleasured. It would not do for them to undo the tiny latches, the wire doors to their cages. It would not do to lift the lids of their terrariums. Something untoward might escape, roam the grounds. But then I should be afraid to walk alone at night, my new hat atop my clean head, walking stick in hand, as I move onward, staking out crevices, damp places that lock my eyes, the fragrant earth I knew atop my inheritance, the herd of them breathing behind me in the dark. At the thrill of their whispers, I stick my stick into the ground, turn on my boot's heel. My wife, on her four legs, waits quietly in the hay.
Thank you.
two more?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like, and I'm not talking about how you never know if you're reading too long or too short. It's like, you know, it's bad and people are unmuted and you're like, oh, no, I'm reading. So I think that, I'm going to read two more poems, and this one is called Thoughts on Wisteria. Now, you all know who Maude Gunn is. So when the speaker says that this person was her Maude Gunn, you know that means she's completely obsessed with that, right? And my client, do you guys have PVC fencing here? Yeah, it's that nasty sort of plastic fencing theory. I got it in a poem. I was very pleased. There's a lot of that happens. Thoughts on Wisteria. You were my Maude Gunn when black ink won, ran down my page like a throat slash attack. You were my bassinet when the bow swung, down came our rockabye, baby. And all those blue-reds swung their orb lights against fences as cop cars pulled their immediacy alongside my house, when you were the fence the drunk driver smashed into in that ice age, knocked at an angle that cracked the frozen plastic of PVC ice fencing jaggedly, still in half, it was your winter. Once you were nearly mine, bar lights dimmed, with the mode of attack I always relied on dumb. Another drink, this time a mojito. You sniffed its sugars, downed it, turned to grind the hip of the girl the room light least. I'm still shoveling snow. I stubbed my toe. I fell down some stairs. One might have thought I was no one, no matter the nightgown. I was never meant to be your girl. The snow plows are out. They are coming for me. And now my envy grows like a tree. Summer me. The wisteria begins the vine, becomes a tree. The needs more years than our species has for it to give us notice of its blossoms, allow our noses to ride its fine fragrance as delinquent bees do now, on hovering, my neighbor's purple piling of growth, a vine that centuries into a tree. It is terrible sweet. Who decides that which is flower, that which is weed? I'm begging its trespass into my yard. Ply its errant length along my voice, try tying it to me. Yet long ago, the stink of a polluted seed found its own accommodation, long moved its lank figure within our orbit, as smoke from my cigarette crawled and whisked through our final barroom brawl. Can I not be anything but maudlin? Snow's never over, nor are blossoms gone. Glasses forever itch in cupboards to be filled with wine, as mouths in dark plot to be kissed. Recall how you once suggested I sit by the sea to relax? I fail to admit the beach here is littered with syringes. This is my goodbye. I wish I lived in a little house by the sea, but I do. And I did. I'm going to actually read two more. One of them is really short, and I just want to read it kind of like because it's kind of referenced in a way in the introduction. And basically, I've been thinking a lot about revision because I'm teaching a master class in revision at Columbia. And if you ever get a chance to see the drafts, and in fact, I can do them here if you want to see them, but it's Adam's Murderer's Rave by James Wright, and there's three different versions of them. And the first versions are incredibly elaborate, and you can see he's really struggling. And then he finally just sort of says it straight out, and it's really interesting the conclusions he comes to. And so this is called Pretty Speech on the Occasion of Your Death. And I wanted to write an elegy, and I realized I was just really angry about the way this funeral went. Pretty Speech, the Occasion of Your Death. Oh, this is about a friend of mine who died on wall rock climbing. So it sort of references like his idiotic thing that he did, which is like a fall while climbing, right? Near the Arctic Circle. When you die, phones clatter off ears to tile floors as phones in movies do. Everyone gasped. No one could breathe. There was a scream. I grew ugly from a distance at the clatter of your boots scuffing rock wall. You always knew how to cause a scene, a scream. Forgive me, your error was obscene. You unlashed over air 800 feet deep. Even my parents paused their DVD. The scent swift, lousy Icarus. Forgive me for being mean. You know how it is. When that old Arctic feeling comes over me, it's extreme. Keeping up appearances makes me pathological. Your death, I've been reading about it. The accounts are practically mythological. I'm more likely to marry a stranger than believe that your cousin, who is on the scene, found, as he claims, your necklace snagged on gray granite, and will always wonder if some greater force led him to it. I mean, please. Dead? You're lucky you missed the memorial service. The spiritual director directed us to wave our arms in unison above our heads. To guide you toward the heavens, in case you got lost, I guess. I'll admit, I was a little pissed. I asked to read a poem. Pastor Mary Cornfed took the folded page from my hands, unfolded it, glanced, and then deemed it inappropriate, as it was awfully intimate. See pages 55 and 60. The faith-healing cunt. I've been in a bad mood ever since. And I've never heard of that. Yeah, I know, it's terrible. I'm going to keep going. Okay, so I'm going to do this poem called An Editing Prize. That will be the last one, I promise. I need to get the meeting about your lives here. Etiquette prize. I don't know if I wore glasses when I met you, but I know the last time I saw you, you drank a drink I bought you with another woman who was far uglier than I have ever been. I have brown eyes, did I ever tell you? Your eyes are too blue, tell all awful, and too pretty. You make all the girls swoon, and then lament how harpies pound on your door, plucking the very shingles off your roof, conducting through their unanimous will a plot to kill your hive's queen, fix a hose from the car's tailpipe, the pump barnyard dread straight into your ken. Therefore you demand I ought never wish to lie in your bed. I have black eyes, did I tell you? Your eyes are damp blue, fingers in winter blue, worrying about a prom date blue, never washed dish blue. Have I mentioned my eyes are dead brown, dirt brown, stone brown, done with you brown, screaming out in the streets I'm so drunk brown, I'm just ignoring the noise rising up from the streets asleep brown? As in, as brown as dead leaves, because my love's eyes were dead brown, and when he shouted down at that drunk on the street that New Year's Eve from my third floor window, that drunk man called him Whiskey Whore Boy. His eyes were not wishwash blue. His eyes were mostly moss and trees, not mojitos in a bar room. His eyes all gin lit in the hotel room on our last night were ice cold. Even in his farewell, he was bold. His eyes anyone might have called clean, but they could at least cry. I am sick to death of your blue eyes, fabric eyes, flower eyes. I have brown eyes, plain and sane eyes behind thick frames, glassy eyes handing themselves over to you in buckets eyes, dig your hands into my black soil eyes, my ugly eyes reaching into your eyes for my twin eyes, look back at me eyes while your eyes crawl the walls, cloud blue, wandering off as milky bosom maids will look away from the eyes that seek the crevices deep between their heavy breasts that sway beneath the cows they bend to milk eyes. Won't you have another drink for my silk beyond your eyes? I may look plain, but I've got roses in my blood, can bloom right out the soil of these here brackish eyes, wander a limb across the chest of your country, unlock the footlocker of your desire with the tip of my lying eyes.